Welcome to Not Enough Champagne, a podcast that will probably get old before it dies. My name's Corey Hazelhurst and my partner in propaganda is Steve Haynes.
Hey Corey.
On this episode, we're talking about pensions. So there was a big kerfuffle over silly season, not over Ken Clark becoming Prime Minister, but on a Centre for Social Justice report that recommended increasing the pension age to 75. What should the position of the left be on pensions? We're going to have a look at the report and see what we think.
You're not meant to read things before you comment on them.
It is hard then to cast a snap judgment. And the interesting thing is that the raising of the pension age is one of a few recommendations in the report, the rest of which are, spoiler alert, actually quite sensible. But we'll get to them as we go. So the report is done by the Centre for Social Justice. That's the think tank that Ian Duncan Smith is behind. The reason why it's there is because we have an issue, I suppose you could say, in Britain or in the West generally, in that we have an ageing population and lower rates of fertility, in that fewer people are having kids and fewer kids in each family, and they estimate that by the 2030s they will be half of UK adults will be over 50 and 29% of UK adults will be over 60, so that equates to about 7 million people. In terms of the number of people in the UK workforce at the moment, the number of people aged between 50 and 64 in the UK workforce has been increasing. So it's gone up from 59% in 1998 to 71.9% in 2018. But you'll notice, if you're good at stats and know your state pension ages, that that means that most workers leave work before they reach the state pension age. So in case you're not sure, I'll be honest, Steve, I haven't really been counting down to the state pension age because I just know it's a long, long way away.
So,
but I'm pleased to tell you, for me anyway, it's below 40 years. I didn't think it would be, so I'm quite excited. So at the moment, the pension age is 65. It'll be 66 by 2020. And the aim at the moment in terms of government policy is that it'll be 68 by 2046. Therefore, the average age that people exit the world of work is about 65.1 for men and 63.9 for women. And there's a few reasons for that. So what the report says is there's a few different reasons why people leave work early. Generally, it's about a third of those people, they leave involuntarily. So they want to continue working, but they can't. And the Centre for Social Justice pinpoints a few reasons for that. One of them is they are made redundant. Another one is they have to leave because of ill health. Another one is that they leave because of lack of skills. And another is that they have caring responsibilities. I mean, that points to one or two things. Speculative question first is, in terms of lack of skills, obviously older people nowadays, it's probably that generation aged 50 to 64, probably the last generation where not a majority of people would have gone to university. Do you think that lack of suitable skills is going to be an issue, say, for our generation or those a little bit older as they come and leave the workforce?
I think it very much depends on, in effect, where technology goes. So when we talk about, oh yeah, you know, people not having the skills in the modern workplace, a lot of that is actually kind of the shift from, in effect, analog to digital. It's computer skills and kind of all the things that come off the back of it. So if there isn't a massive technological shift in some capacity, then no, I wouldn't necessarily imagine that our generation, for instance, would struggle too much. But if we do see some form of shift, I think the kind of the biggest classic example of this might very well be a form of, you know, increased automation. Then you might start to see our kind of generation starting to kind of fall into that same trap, because suddenly the more lower skilled jobs, I say lower skilled, but you know, you're suddenly, certain types of jobs, like, say, taxi drivers, like your Uber drivers, your black cabs and things like that, well, you don't need them anymore because we've got self-driving cars. lorry drivers. We don't need them anymore because they can drive themselves safely to and from everywhere. Long haulage is disruptive massively and becomes immediately cheaper with massive benefits for everybody other than the drivers. In those sorts of circumstances, absolutely, you will have people who are lacking skills to get back into the workplace. But you're probably going to see it not as widespread unless there's a more unless there's another significant technology jump between what, you know, what we're used to and what we've grown up with to something else.
Yeah, and it's interesting, like, talking about low skilled jobs, because actually there are jobs like, say, some sort of accounting skills which traditionally seen as skilled jobs
which can go.
On the other hand, it's very hard to automate, say, caring roles.
Yeah.
Because they tend to be ones that need to be done by people rather than robots. So in terms of even what we think about a skilled job is a kind of interesting
thing. Absolutely. And when it comes to automation, for instance, you know, we tend to focus on, oh, we don't have any cashiers or as I say, like taxi drivers or tube drivers is a classic thing, you know. An awful lot of the middle class kind of jobs are all, can be largely automated as well. One of my old clients at my last job was a software company who developed effectively machine learning software for legal firms. So what they did was basically you scanned in the legal document, and after some setup and basically some teaching it what you needed it to do, it could basically just go, here, we're going to highlight to you in this document all the problematic things based on the standard kind of things that you look at. You now need two fewer lawyers in your office. You know, this sort of stuff can affect everybody.
And that is a bit of a problem because, as historians of the French Revolution will know, it's not the poor you have to be aware of, it's the poor lawyers. So it's a terrifying prospect. I think the other thing in terms of those different issues, in terms of ill health, lack of skills, caring responsibilities, is, again, we have the podcast that's on pensions, and therefore we'll put pensions in the title, and we'll probably talk about raising the pension age to 75 because we all love a bit of clickbait, don't we, listeners? But I think the interesting thing with, of course, the pensions issue is it's really hard to silo off issues. I know I shouldn't get surprised at this in terms of public policy, but sorting pensions is so much more than just giving someone a pension and increasing that pension in line with inflation. It's a skills issue. It's sorting social care, for instance.
I mean, heaven forbid that we actually try and sort social care out.
I think they've been trying since... Well, it's at least Gordon Brown, isn't it? But there's, so it's interesting in terms of, say, UK adults in work. UK slightly, I think, below OECD average, but above the European average. Looking at, say, countries like Sweden, who have a very high, about 80% of their adults are in work, they only have 8% of that age group are carers, which is half the UK amount, which is about 15%. And of course, conversely, Sweden spends almost double the amount of its GDP on social care than we do. So we spend around about 1.4% of our GDP on social care, on long-term care. In Sweden, it's 2.6. The other thing, actually, which is, I think, interesting, is the inequality issue. The report also says that those who have lower incomes at the moment will have a higher retirement age. Common sense, I suppose, in a way, because if you have a lower income, it is harder for you to save money, and therefore you have less money when you retire.
Yeah.
Of course, compounded onto that is, if you have a lower income, you're also more likely to face the challenges like disability, ill health, lack of qualifications or caring responsibilities that come with leaving the workforce early. So you've kind of got a double whammy. It's interesting that when, sitting on the left, I think, you think of inequality and we think of income inequality, we think of different jobs that the rich and poor do. Certainly in the discussions I've had with friends, it's that emotive thing, isn't it? If you don't want to have 75-year-olds, you know, working on building sites, say, and really, or in kind of traditionally working class manual jobs. But actually, if you think about it from the Centre for Social Justice, you know, Ian Duckersmith think tank, you can be a 75-year-old accountant, MP, whatever.
Yeah.
A more white-collar job, yeah, you could say.
Absolutely. Like, I mean, just compare and contrast as you were the, as you know, somebody who works in education and teaching versus me who works in an office. Like, I will almost certainly be able to do my job longer just because it's not as physically or mentally demanding, like, on the day-to-day. It's not that it's necessarily easy, but I don't have to, you know, corral kids or anything like that, which is massive, requires a lot more energy than sitting down thinking, which is what I do for most of the day.
And that is interesting as well, because the other thing from the report is the different distribution of industries. So it's interesting you mentioned teaching, even health, because there's an interesting disparity between male and female roles in this. So with female workers aged between 15 and 64, more than half of them are in public administration or education or healthcare. Male workers, much more evenly spread. Again, public education, health, biggest area, but still quite a few. There's about 12, 13, 14% of male workers between 15 and 64 working in manufacturing. There's a similar number, a little bit less, in construction as well. So still a lot of people working quite heavy manual jobs. Another way in which the inequality is seen is in terms of life expectancies in different areas. And the fact that Frances Ryan, who's a very interesting writer on disability, wrote about this when she was writing her take on the report for The Guardian. She mentions an area of Glasgow where the life expectancy for a man at the moment born this year is 73.9. And if you raise the pension age to 75, you're basically saying those people should work until death. The life expectancy in Birmingham, where we are recording this podcast on a biography of Roy Jenkins at this very moment, is 77.9. So the average Brummie will be able to retire for just less than 3 years. But I think in that, I think I'm right in saying it's about, in terms of inequality of life expectancies, it's about 18 years difference between the biggest and least life expectancies. So that's a huge disparity of ages based on all sorts of things, isn't it, in terms of income inequality?
Yeah, I mean, there's so many different things which kind of feed into income inequality and its effects. So we would need like a podcast just to go into that on its own. Although if you do want an interesting book to read on it, it's not perfect, but the spirit level,
yeah,
is pretty decent. Some of its points are basically aren't as accurate as they initially made out, but the general thesis I think holds up.
Yeah, holds up really well.
But yeah, so it is absolutely kind of like shocking and stark how big a difference there is in between like the rich areas of society and the kind of like the poorer ones in terms of life expectancy. So we then do effectively, as you say, end up in this situation where we're going, it's almost like a separate type of inequality that the pensions debate kind of feeds into. And again, as you said, everything's kind of not siloed off, it's all part of one big conversation, is that kind of that life expectancy difference. Because ultimately, as you say, if we're saying you need to retire at X age, let's use 75 as an example, just for the sake of argument, but you have large portions of society which are the average life expectancy isn't going to hit that's a massive issue and a massive problem which needs to be addressed in some capacity. And again, this report, because it's not, it's coming at this from a right-wing perspective, it's coming at this from and as such it's looking at it from purely from the economic sense rather than looking at it from anything else. Flaw in the report, but not necessarily a surprise. If this were a left-wing report, it may very well have completely forgotten the economic side of things, like to be brutally honest. So take all reports with a pinch of salt and test their priors, and try and work out where they're coming from. So what we probably need to look to do is try and combine all of these different facets to try and create something that's actually meaningful and effective. Based on the coverage that this has gotten so far, and partially this is just because of that kind of like that very kind of clickbaity headline of let's increase the retirement age and the age for pensions up to 75 or whatever it is, that immediately sets the tone. When actually, when you look into the report itself, there's quite a bit in there that's quite interesting and actually one might even say progressive, or at the very least in the sense of these are the sorts of issues that the left needs to be looking at.
I think, as we'll see when we come on to some of its recommendations, there's definitely the echoes of an emerging political consensus, I think, in the report, in terms of what it talks about mental health, say, which is really interesting. And certainly, it's not quite as gung-ho as, say, the Institute of Economic Affairs, which it quotes in the report saying that somehow retirement has a detrimental effect on other people's health. You can sort of, I almost don't want to say it because it'll be taken out of context. You can sort of see the IEA's point on the impact of retirement.
Yeah, for what the IEA is saying is essentially, hey, you know, sometimes people who retire, them working was actually their connection to society, you know, and maybe they then suffer some mental health issues as a result of being cut off from that. Now, that is almost certainly true for some people. But it's some, and what the IEA has probably done, which they tend to do a lot, is take the extreme and blow it up into saying, "Oh, this is everything. Everybody must suffer from this." And, you know, I'm sure they've got some data. I'm sure they've got some research. But yeah, that tends to be what the IEA, in from what I've read, tends to end up doing. More specifically, though, it kind of does again. IEA, right wing free market think tank. Highlights a really good point, though, in that there are some people who will have detrimental impacts from just being retired that aren't necessarily linked to not having enough money or anything like that, because there are just going to be other things at play. There are people out there whose maybe their only family have all passed on. Maybe they don't necessarily have a lot of friends and their social life was their work life. Those people will potentially be at risk from more mental health issues when they retire, unless they can find something else to fill the time. We need to be able to enable that in some capacity and to ensure that those people are kept busy, fit and healthy. And IEA is not going to be coming any proposals for that, but it's a problem they've identified, which we need to be providing solutions to.
I mean, as with the IEA, a lot of things is, I will take you seriously when you tell me who funds you.
Yeah.
But I think there's a couple of issues there which you've kind of highlighted. I think one of them is, it's interesting that in the debate in the 1990s and the 80s as well, was pension and poverty. It was something stupid like, I think a third of UK pensioners were in poverty. And in 1997 or 8, I think it was, there was the New Labour 65p increase in the state pension age, which was just seen as an insult.
Yeah.
And what's interesting is that's kind of shifted in terms of the rate of pensioner income poverty has gone down. But instead, there's a crisis of loneliness among a lot of UK pensioners, which kind of is highlighting, and again, it's that kind of mental health issue which we talked about before. I think the other thing that highlights is, it's similar to some of the debates that I had around UBI and a 15-hour week, aren't they? Because you always have these people who say, well, and they tend to be quite, on the left anyway, tend to be people who believe in the dignity of work as a good thing in itself, rather than just a bloody inconvenience, I was like, well, what would people do if they only work 15 hours a week? And you think, well, they'd make music or write poetry or record podcasts or do stuff that they enjoy. Like it's almost like you can do stuff and not work and that's all right. It's just about being busy with things you enjoy.
Yeah.
So, you know, working to live rather than living to work.
Yeah.
Which, again, probably needs investment in a lot of parks and community things and what have you. The big society, one might say, which again I suppose shows the non-siloed nature of this kind of pensions debate. Everything feeds into lots of different areas.
Yeah, and I think actually the fact that so much of the what we're discussing in terms of pensions feeds off into lots of different other areas of policy, because suddenly we're now talking about parks and community centres, and that's DCLG. Suddenly we've been talking about social care, and that's the health department. Suddenly we're talking about, you know, job skills. That's work and pensions. You've got so many different areas which all feed into this. And I think that's probably one of the reasons why it's been very difficult for governments of any sort to kind of get to grips with this as a potential issue, because it cuts across so many areas and because it becomes very, very complex. If you look at most kind of like pension ministers, an awful lot of them aren't necessarily experts in pensions.
The only one I can think of is Steve Webb.
And even then, what he was focused on and what he was looking at was still a very narrow definition of pensions and the issues that we're facing, because what his big reform was basically freeing people up to be able to withdraw money early, which works for some people, but it's not solving any of these issues that we're talking about now. Strip away that retirement age. There's an awful lot in this report, for instance, which you can build some consensus around.
If you look at the report from how do we get people aged 50 to 64 into work, then I think it's interesting, because the report then moves on to say, well, actually, older workers less likely to have accidents than their younger counterparts. Also disproportionately likely to have fatal accidents. But equally as productive. So McDonald's do customer satisfaction surveys, found that there were 20% higher customer satisfaction where all the staff were employed, which is an interesting little nugget.
Oh God, that's a terrible pun.
Oh God, that wasn't even... that wasn't even intentional. Oh dear. It's good that I'm always...
It's good, you need to leave that in.
Yeah, I'll leave that in. And there are benefits to all the people working in terms of being healthier, being happier. Because obviously in terms of the politics of the report, Ian Duncan Smith tweets out that we need to remove barriers to older people working, and everyone basically says, what the hell are you doing? That sounds like dystopia to me. But again, because they've gone for a, we need to try and solve this economic problem, the way to do that is to raise the pension age. A lot of the interesting stuff in how do you get older people...
how do you adapt workplaces to older
individuals? And so for instance, there's one of the recommendations in the report is that GPs should be trained more in occupational health and being able to recommend courses to employees based on that. Another recommendation in the report is to make sure there's clear guidance to both workers and bosses that you need to treat mental health in the same way as you treat physical health. Again, something that probably one of the few almost legacies Theresa May has, maybe, is that that's an emerging political consensus, yep. I think. Another recommendation in the report is to increase provisions for flexible working. So at the moment, I think you can only request flexible working after working there for a company for 6 months. They're saying you should have it from day one. There's also a national retraining scheme. So we mentioned that skills is often a big reason why older people can't rejoin the workplace. So having some sort of personalised learning account. Not quite sure how I feel about that necessarily. Feels a bit neoliberal to me.
But the principle behind it, effectively, of lifelong learning.
Yeah.
That's a good thing.
Maybe we could call it a national education service.
You're just trying to make me rage now.
But even stuff like adjusting the workspaces. So for instance, quotes a case study of BMW. They tried to innovate on their production line. They had an average age of 47. They made 70 changes, including wooden flooring and weight-adapted footwear to reduce joint strain, ergonomic chairs for resting between breaks, putting in extra magnifying glasses so they could see that to reduce eye strain. And the pilot line achieved a 7% productivity improvement and equaled the productivity of line staff by younger workers. And absenteeism drops by 2%. So there are companies that are doing this. And in terms of that productivity problem that we are keep being told, well, part of that, the reason there's a productivity problem is because companies aren't investing.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of things in that report in terms of, as I say, National Education Service, lifelong learning, focusing on mental health, making sure that workers are treated well at work. Lots of things there that actually you could make a progressive end for rather than just a financial bean counting end.
I feel that, but almost that is the most interesting part of this report, is that there's so much in there which is relevant and useful from a left-wing perspective, despite coming from a right-wing think tank. It does very much show that there is this potential for an area of consensus, which could be quite radical in its impact. It may not be kind of like necessarily headline grabbing in the way like a lot of policies are, but in terms of its overall impact on society, I struggle to name. Like, I suspect if you could get this right, you'd be making significant impacts for the better across an awful lot of areas. Because here's the thing, an awful lot of those things you're talking about, you know, making sure that you've got better chairs, making sure you've got better uniform shoes for people to use and things like that. Yeah, a lot of that's going to help. That's aimed primarily at obviously helping the older members of the workforce. It's still going to be beneficial for everybody else as well. Like preventing eye strain, for instance, that's something that everybody does and is something which is going to become even more and more of an issue as we stare longer and longer at computers every day.
And I think it's one of those things where, from the Labour point of view, is that's why you need unions. It's why you need a union rep, because that's exactly the kind of thing you could task a union rep with campaigning for and doing as well.
Yeah. So everything doesn't have to be done by government diktat from centrally.
Yeah. And again, I suppose then the problem with, the main cleavage then between your more centre for social justice approach and, you know, a social democratic socialist approach, I suppose, is essentially the amount of money you are willing to commit to the problem. And therefore, a socialist approach is more willing to spend more money and not raise that pension age. Mm-hmm. And I think also, probably, it's about, yes, more people working, but it's also how you approach work. And I can completely see, like, some of those recommendations on occupational health and what have you folded in with things like a 4-day work week, even like increasing bank holidays. Like, I know you're not a fan of the policy per se, but just increasing the amount of paid leave that workers are entitled to is a way of doing that. I thought, actually, just to finish off, I'd look at actually what does... I thought I'd go back to the Bible of all socialist thought, which is Labour's 2017 manifesto, and go back and say, what was our line on pensions then? Bear in mind, I've just gone to look at the section that says, I think it's called Looking After Older People or something. I don't think there's anything else on pensions on it, but I'm willing to be corrected. But page and a half, Labour would keep the triple lock on pensions, keep stuff like the winter fuel allowance, make provisions for WASPI women, doesn't really commit on the pension age, says it will have some sort of commission to look in what the pension age should be, probably raise it to 83.
183,
then the socialist dream would have been completely accomplished. And then also at cracking down on exploitative pension funds, because something we haven't really talked about is the extent to which it's been possible for that they... Osborne making it possible for people to sell off their pension and cash in early, yeah, is leading to problems in older age, and also opportunities for fraudsters as well, which the Times, I think, did an investigation on a few months ago. And there's a wonderful sentence. I won't quote it all, but the main bit is, a Labour government will commit to an immediate review of the mine workers' pension scheme and British coal superannuation scheme surplus, sharing arrangements between government and scheme beneficiaries.
I've got no idea what even any of that means.
Well, it must just be, there's obviously some...
There's a trade union somewhere responsible for that.
Yeah. Look, I don't care what else is in this damn thing. That's going in.
Yeah, this is Labour policy now. It's delightful that it's in there, actually. I mean, it's... Because, to be honest, like, broadly speaking, there's not a lot in there, really, that's meaningful.
No.
So we've got... WASPI, you know, the campaign for WASPI women, yeah, which affects a very small number of people. You've got a coal superannuation scheme for miners, which God only knows what that is. And then we've got some generic statements on, we'll look into the retirement age.
I mean, as we've said, a lot of the problem is on different policy areas. Yeah. So if you were to look in, the social care, which is literally the next page of the manifesto, there's probably some stuff on that. I mean, as we know now, the National Education Service policy is so watertight now, there's probably something on lifelong learning and retraining. And so in that sense, like, our policy offer, I think, is... It's probably there, and it's probably better than the Tories is. But it's interesting how...
It's the framing of it,
yeah,
more than anything, I feel. It's almost like... I feel like there's probably a very much a case to be made that Labour could make of actually kind of saying we need a government that does look after you from the cradle to the grave for the 21st century. We've lost that. Because then you can, a lot of these kind of policy areas like lifelong work learning cut across all of that, education cuts across all of that, social care cuts across all of that, and you're able to kind of craft this kind of narrative which people will understand and it will resonate with them. Maybe you don't quite rip off old slogans so hard as I just did then, but you know, something like that as a central narrative could be very, very effective, and you can then weave all of the things that you need to do to sort out pensions, which is a technocratic and boring thing which a lot of people don't pay attention to, in a wider discussion, so that you can actually make the impacts that you need to make.
Yeah, you can tell we've not really done the economics,
yeah,
on this. I suppose the issue with framing it is, if you're going to say a Labour government will make it easier for you to work until you're 65 and not retire early, it's probably... that's obviously, cradle to the grave is an easier sell.
Yeah. But it's about the freedom. Your freedom to choose how you live your life. It's your 4-day work week, so you've got time so that you can invest in your hobbies and maybe help, maybe even turn that into an entrepreneurial enterprise for yourself. Maybe it's not your sole job, but it helps bring in more money and you're able to put that back into the community. That kind of thing. You link it up to a wider thing, and you can do something with it. It's freedom to choose how you live your life. You can't really argue against that very effectively, other than how much is it going to cost, and as long as you've costed it and you know where it's coming from. Yes, people might still kind of vote against it from a notion of I don't want to pay more tax, but you can win that argument.
Shall we end on some hope?
That makes a nice change.
So we are hoping to do more discussions on policy. And
do you remember the days when we used to have weeks on weeks just discussing policy rather than Brexit?
No, I don't, to be honest. And we'd like to bring them back. We'd like to bring the podcast like how it was in the good old days.
Make Not Enough Champagne great again.
We're at notenoughchampagne.com. We're at facebook.com/notenoughchampagne. We're at nochampagnepod on Twitter. James Cram designed our logo. You can follow him on Twitter at James Cram. And Dave Depp is responsible for our theme tune, Plucky Good Times. My Twitter handle is at Paperback Writer.
Mine's at Acoustic Radical.
Happy plotting.